were made routine. Cytospora cankers killed the stone fruit orchards of Nova Scotia. Vadim was very sad at this loss of his favorite fruits. Citrus in the Balkans gave way to the green disease, then the quick decline. Root rots became more and more common, and could only be countered by beneficial fungi and bacteria outcompeting the pathogens. The mutation rate of the pathogens appeared to be faster than the genetic engineers' so-called ripostifers. Wilting resulted when fungi or bacteria clogged a plant's water circulation. Clubroot was caused by a fungus that could reside in the soil for years without manifesting. They began to adjust soil pHs to at least 6.8 before planting cruciform vegetables. Mildews also persisted in the soil for several years and were dispersed by the wind. They kept the locks between biomes closed all the time now. Each biome had its own set of problems and diseases, its own suite of solutions. All these plant diseases they were seeing had been with them from the start of the voyage, carried on board in the soil and on the first plants. That so many were manifesting now was, of course, much remarked, and many regarded the phenomena as a mystery, even some kind of curse. People spoke of the seven plagues of Egypt or the Book of Job. But the pathologists on the farms and in the labs said it was simply a matter of soil imbalances and genetic inbreeding, all aspects of island, biogeography, or zoo devolution, or whatever one called the isolation they had been living in for 200 years. In the privacy of Badim and Freya's apartment, Aram was unsparing in his judgment of the situation.
"We're drowning in our own shit."
Badim tried to help him see it in a more positive light, using their old game.
"One will only do one's best when forced to live in one's own fouled nest."
Slowly but surely, as the seasons passed, plant pathology became their principal area of study. Leaf spots were the result of a vast array of fungi species. Molds resulted from wet conditions. Smut was fungal. Nematode invasions caused reduced growth, wilting, loss of vigor, and excessive branching of roots. They tried to reduce the nematode populations by solarizing the soil, and this worked to a certain extent, but the process took the soil involved out of the crop rotation for at least one season. Identification of viral infections in plant tissues was often accomplished, if that was the word, only by the elimination of all other possible causes of a problem. Leaf distortions, mottling, streaking, these were usually viral diseases.
"Why did they bring along so many diseases?" Freya asked Yoki once when she was out visiting him.
He laughed at her.
"They didn't. There are hundreds of plant diseases they managed to keep out of the ship. Thousands, even."
"But why bring any at all?"
"Some were part of cycles they wanted. Most they didn't even know they had."
Long silence from Freya.
"Why are they all hitting us now?"
"They aren't. Only a few are hitting you. It just seems like a lot because your margin for error is so small, because your ship is so small."
Freya never commented on the way Yoki always referred to everything on the ship as yours and never ours, as if he had no involvement at all with them.
"I'm getting scared," she said. "What if going back was a bad idea? What if the ship is too old to make it?"
"It was a bad idea,"
Yoki replied, and laughed again at her expression.
"It's just that all the other ideas were worse. And listen, the ship is not too old to make it. You just have to deal. Keep all the balls in the air for another 130 years or so. That's not impossible."
She did not reply. After a minute, Yoki said,
"Hey, do you want to go out and take a look at the stars?"
"I guess so. Do you?"
"Yes, I do."
Yoki got into one of the fairy spacesuits and left by way of the fairy's smallest lock. Freya got into one of the spacesuits left in the lock at the Inner Ring's Spoke 3 complex. They met in the space between the spine and the Inner Ring, just ahead of the fairy, and floated, tethered in that space. They hung there, suspended, floating in the interstellar medium, tethered each to their own little refuge. Exposure to cosmic radiation was much higher out there than in most of the interior spaces of the ship, or even in Yoki's ferry. But an hour or two per year, or even an hour or two per month, did not change the epidemiological situation very much. We too were, of course, perpetually exposed to cosmic rays, and in fact, damage occurred to us. But we were, for the most part, more robust under the impact of this perpetual deluge, which remained invisible and intangible to humans, and thus something they seldom thought about. For most of their EVA, the two friends floated in silence, looking around. The city and the stars.
What if things fall apart? Freya asked at one point.
Things always fall apart. I don't know.
After that, they floated in silence for the rest of their time out there, holding gloved hands, looking away from the ship and Sol, off in the direction of the constellation Orion. When it was time to go back in, they hugged, at least to the extent this was possible in their spacesuits. It looked as if two gingerbread cookies were trying to merge. At 10:34 a.m. on 198.088, the lights went out in Labrador, and the backup generators came on, but Labrador Sunline stayed off. Big portable lights were set up to illuminate the dark biome, and fans were set up in the locked doors at either end to shove air from the Pampas into Labrador and thence out into Patagonia to keep the air warm. The new wheat could live without light for a few days, but would react badly to the cold that would result from the lack of light. Adjustments were made to the heating in the Pampas to help mitigate the chill now flowing into Patagonia, which was also being turned into farmland, and the newly bolstered Labradoran population walked over to Plata so that the repair crews could work without fear of injuring anyone. Running through the standard troubleshooting protocols did not succeed in locating the source of the problem, which was cause for alarm. A more fine-grained test rubric that we found and applied determined that the gases and salts in the arc tubes that made up the sunline, particularly the metal halide and high-pressure sodium, but also the xenon and the mercury vapor, had diminished to the point of failure, either by diffusion through nanometer-sized holes in the alumina arc tubes, or by contact with the electrodes in the ballasts, or by bonding to the quartz and ceramic arc tubes. Many of the sunlines also used krypton 85 to supplement the argon in some tubes, and thorium in the electrodes, and these being radioactive were over time losing their effectiveness in boosting the arc discharge. All these incremental losses meant that the best solution was for new lamps to be manufactured in the printers, lofted into position by the big cherry pickers that had already rolled around Ring B from Sonora, installed, and turned on. When they did those things, light returned to Labrador, then its people. The old lamps were recycled, their recoverable materials returned to the various feedstock storage units. Eventually, some of the lamps escaped argon and sodium could be filtered out of the ambient air, but not all. Some atoms of these elements had bonded with other elements in the ship. Those were effectively lost to them. In the end, the Labrador blackout was just a little crisis. And yet it brought on many instances of higher blood pressure, insomnia, talk of nightmares. Indeed, some said that life in the ship these days was like living in a nightmare. In 199,
There were crop failures in Labrador, Patagonia, and the prairie. Food reserves at that point were stockpiled to an amount that would feed the population of the ship, now 953 people, for only 6 months. This was not at all unusual in human history. In fact, it was very near the average food reserve, as far as historians had been able to determine. But that was neither here nor there. Now, with shortages caused by the bad harvest, they were forced to draw down on this reserve.
"What else can we do?"
Badim said, when Aram complained about this.
"That's what a reserve is for."
"Yes, but what happens when it runs out?"
Aram replied. The plant pathologists worked hard to understand the failures fast enough to invent new integrated pest management strategies, and they tried an array of new chemical and biological pesticides, discovered either in the ship's labs or by way of studying the feeds from Earth. They introduced genetically modified plants that would better withstand whatever pathogens were found to be infecting the plants. They converted all the land in all the biomes to farmland. They gave up on winters, creating speeded-up spring-summer-fall cycles. With all these actions performed together, they had created a multivariant experiment. They were not going to be able to tell which actions caused whatever results they got. As new crops were planted in the newly scheduled springtimes, it began to seem that fear could be thought of as one of the infectious diseases striking them. People were now hoarding, a tendency that badly disrupts throughput in a system. Loss of social trust could easily lead to a general panic, then to chaos and oblivion. Everyone knew this, which added to the level of fear. At the same time, in spite of the growing danger, there were still no security officers on the ship, nor any authority but what the populace exerted over itself through the Executive Council, which was now, in effect, the Security Council as well. Despite Badim's earlier insistence on governance over anarchism, they still had no sheriff. In that sense, they were always on the edge of anarchy, and the perception of this reality, of course, also added to their fear. One day, Aram came into their apartment with a new study by the plant pathologists.
"It looks like we may have started this voyage a bit short on bromine," he said. "Of the 92 naturally occurring elements, 29 are essential for animal life, and one of those is bromine. As bromide ions, it stabilizes the connective tissues called basement membranes, which are in everything living. It's part of the collagen that holds things together. But the whole ship appears to have been a bit short of it, right from the start. Delwyn is guessing they tried to lower the total salt load on board, and this was an accidental result."
"Can we print some of it?" Freya asked.
Aram gave her a startled look.
"You can't print an element, my dear."
"No?"
"No. That only happens inside exploding stars and the like. The printers can only shape whatever feedstock materials we give them."
"Ah, yes," Freya said. "I guess I knew that."
"That's all right. I don't recall hearing much about bromine,"
Budim said.
"It's not an element one hears about much, but it turns out to be important. So that could explain some things we haven't been understanding."
People began to go hungry. Food rationing was instituted by a democratic vote taken on the recommendations of a committee formed to make suggestions concerning the emergency. The vote was 615 to 102. One day, Freya was called to Sonora, asked to address some kind of undefined emergency.
"Don't go,"
Badim called by phone to ask her. This was truly a strange request coming from him, but by that time, she was already there, and when she saw the situation, she sat on the nearest bench and hunched over miserably. a group of 5 young people had put plastic bags over their heads and suffocated themselves. One had scrawled a note. "Because we are too many. This has to stop," she said, when she managed to stand back up. But the next week, a pair of teenagers broke the lock code and launched themselves out of the bow dock of the spine, without tethers or even spacesuits. They too had left a note behind.
"I am just going out for a while, and maybe some time."
Appeal to tradition. Roman virtue. Sacrifice of the one for the many. A very human thing. They called a general assembly and met on the great plaza of San Jose, where so much had already happened. On the other hand, by now only about half of them were old enough to have been alive during the crisis on Aurora and the schism that followed. The older people present therefore looked at the younger people with spooked expressions. "You don't know what happened here," the old people said. The younger people tended to look quizzical. "Don't we? Are you sure? Is that bad?" When everyone who was going to come was there, a complete account of their food situation was made. Silence fell in the plaza. Freya then got up to speak.
"We can make it through this," she said. "There are not too many of us. It's wrong to say that. We only have to hold together. In fact, we need all of us here to do the things we need to do. So there can't be any more of these suicides. We need all of us. There's food enough. We only have to take care and regulate what we eat and match it to what we grow. It will be all right, but only if we take care of each other. You've all heard the figures now. You can see that it will work. So let's do that. We have an obligation to all the others who made it work in this ship, and to those yet to come. 206 years so far, 130 years to go. We can't let the generations down, our parents, our children. We have to show courage in the hard time. I wouldn't want ours to be the generation that let all the others down."
Faces flushed, eyes bright. People stood up and faced her, their hands raised overhead, palms facing her like sunflowers, or eyes on stalks, or yes votes, or something we could not find an analogy to. "The ship is sick," people said. "It's too complex a machine, and it's been running nonstop for over 200 years. Things are going wrong. It's partly alive, and so it's getting old, maybe even dying. It's a cyborg, and the living parts are getting diseased, and the diseases are attacking the non-living parts. We can't replace the parts, because we're inside them, and we need them working at all times. So things are going wrong."
"Maintenance and repair,"
Freya would say to these sentiments.
"Maintenance and repair and recycling, that's all. It's the house we live in. It's the ship we sail in. There's always been maintenance and repair and recycling. So hold it together, don't get melodramatic. Let's just keep doing it. We've got nothing else to do with our time anyway, right?"
But the missing bromine was seldom discussed, and their attempts to recapture some of it by recycling the soil and then the plastic surfaces inside the ship were only partly successful. And there were other elements that were bonding to the ship in difficult ways as well, creating new metabolic rifts, important shortages. This was not something they could ration their way out of. And though it was seldom discussed, almost everyone in the ship was aware of it. When they ran out of stored food and a nematode infestation killed most of the new crop in the prairie, they called another assembly. Rationing was established in full, as per the advice of the working committee, and new rules and practices outlined. Rabbit hutches were expanded, and tilapia ponds. But as it was pointed out, even the rabbits and tilapia needed food. They could eat these creatures the very moment they got to a certain size, but they wouldn't get to that size unless they were fed. So despite their amazing reproductive capacity, these creatures were not the way out of the problem. It was a systemic agricultural problem of feedstocks, inputs, growth, outputs, and recycling. Controlling their diseases was a matter of integrated pest management, successfully designed and applied. There was an entire giant field of knowledge and past experiences to help them. They had to adjust, adapt, move into a new and tighter food regimen, cope with the missing elements as best they could. One aspect of integrated pest management was chemical pesticides. They still had supplies of these, and their chemical factories had the feedstocks to make more. Howbeit they were harmful to humans, which they were, they still had to be used. Time to be a bit brutal if they had to be, and take some risks they wouldn't ordinarily take, at least in certain biomes. Run some quick experiments and quickly find out what worked best. If more food now was paid for by more cancers later, that was the price they had to pay. Risk assessment and risk management came to the fore as subjects of discussion. People had to sort out their sense of the probabilities here, make judgments based on values they hadn't really had to examine, that they had taken for granted. No one was getting pregnant now. Eventually, that too would become a problem, but they had to deal with the problem at hand. Soybeans needed to be protected at all costs from soil pathogens, as they desperately needed the protein that soy could best provide. Biome by biome, they dug up all the soil in the entire starship, cleaned it of pathogens as best they could, while leaving the helpful bacteria alive as much as possible. Then they put it back into cultivation and tried again. There were still crop failures. People now ate 1,500 calories a day and stopped expending energy recreationally. Everyone lost weight. They kept the children's rations at levels that would keep them developmentally normal.
No fat-bellied, stick-legged little kids.
Not yet.
Despite this precaution, the new children were exhibiting a lot of abnormalities. Balance problems, growth issues, learning disabilities. It was hard to tell why. Indeed, impossible. There were a multitude of symptoms or disorders. Statistically, it was not greatly different than it had been for previous generations. But anecdotally, it had become so prominent that every problem was noticed and remarked. The cognitive error called ease of representation thrust them into a space where every problem they witnessed convinced them they were in an unprecedented collapse. They were getting depressed. Throughout history, people had sickened and died. But now when these things happened, it looked like it was because of the ship, which we considered a problem. But it was only one of many. Most days in the last hours before sunset, Vadim would walk down to the corniche running up the west side of the fetch and settle at the railing over the water and fish for a while. There was a limit of one fish per day per fisher, and the railing was lined with people trying to make that catch to add to the evening's meal. It was not exactly a crowd, because luck was generally not very good at this end of Long Pond. Still, there were a number of regulars who were there almost every day, most of them elderly, but a few of them young parents with their kids. Vadim liked seeing them, and did pretty well at remembering their names from one day to the next. Sometimes Freya would come by in the dusk and walk him home. Sometimes he could show her a little perch or tilapia or trout.
"Let's make a fish stew."
"Sounds good, Bibi."
"Did we ever used to do this in the old days?"
"No, I don't think so. You and Devi were too busy then."
"Too bad."
"Remember the time we went sailing?"
"Oh, yes. I crashed us into the dock."
"Only that one time."
"Ah, good. good for us. I couldn't be sure if we did it a lot, or if I just keep remembering that one time.
I know what you mean, but I think it happened just the once. Then we figured out how to do it.
That's nice. Like cooking our stew.
Yes.
You'll help me eat it?
Oh, yes. Won't say no to that.
They turned on the lights in their apartment's kitchen, and he got out the frying pan while she took out a cutting board and filleting knife and gutted the fish. Its steaks, when they were ready, were about 15 centimeters long. When she was sure she had gotten all the bones out of the meat, she chopped the steaks into chunks, while Badim chopped potatoes. He left the skins on. Chicken stock, a little water, a little milk, salt and pepper, some chopped carrots. They worked together in silence. As they ate, Badim said,
"How is it going at work?"
"Ah, well, better if Devi were there."
He nodded.
"I often think that."
"Me too."
"Funny, you two didn't get along when you were young."
"That was my fault."
Badim laughed.
"I don't think so."
"I didn't understand what she was going through."
"That always comes later."
"When it's too late."
"Well, but it's never too late. My father, now he was a real demon for the rules. Sometimes he would make me walk around the whole ring if he thought I wasn't being respectful of the rules. It was only later I understood that he was old when I was born, that he wasn't going to have any kids until he met my mom, because he had been born right after the Troubles, and growing up, he had it hard. I didn't figure it out until after he was gone. But then when I did, I started to understand your mother better. She and my dad had a lot in common somehow."
He sighed.
"It's hard to believe they're both gone."
"I know."
"I'm glad I still have you, dear."
"Me, you too."
Then when they had cleaned up and she was leaving, he said,
"Tomorrow?"
"Yes, tomorrow or the next day. Tomorrow morning I'm going to go to the Piedmont and see how they're doing."
"Have they got a problem too?"
"Oh yes, problems everywhere, you know."
He laughed.
"You sound like your mom."
Freya did not laugh. All kin relationships are roughly similar. There is attention, regard, solicitousness, affection, sharing of news, of burdens physical and psychic. On 208.285, it registered that the pH of Long Pond had shifted markedly lower in just a 2-week span, and a robotic visual inspection of the lake bottom at first found nothing. Then a localized pH reading, gridded to 50 meter squares, indicated the lake water was most acidic near the shore opposite the fetch, where the prevailing winds typically first hit the water. A new robotic inspection found a long depression in the mud, and under that, it was determined that the pond lining had broken or been cut by something, so that the water was in direct contact with the biome's flooring. The resulting corrosion of the container was causing the acidification. Then a further visual inspection by lake divers revealed depressions running lengthwise down the entire middle of the lake. It was decided to drain the lake and store its water, move the fish and other lake life either to a temporary home or kill and freeze it for food. The mud would have to be bulldozed around to allow direct access to the breaks in the liner. This was a blow, as one day Long Pond simply wasn't there anymore, but was instead a long bowl of black mud, drying out and stinking in the daylight. Looking down from the fetch's corniche railing, it was as if they were looking down into a mud pit on the side of some dreadful volcano. Many residents of the fetch left town and stayed with friends in other biomes, but at least as many stayed in town and suffered along with their lake. Of course, there were no fish to catch and take home, though it was said often that they would soon be back, and everything as before. Meanwhile, many of them were that much hungrier. Long Pond was the biggest lake in the ship. Average weight loss among adults was now 10 kilos. Then a fire in a transformer in the prairie spewed a thick, toxic smoke through that biome and forced a complete evacuation so that the biome could be locked up without trapping anyone inside. The fire was fought with robots, which made it a slower process. Indeed, they could not contain the blaze, and it became necessary to remove the air from the biome to end it. This briefly reduced temperatures in the biome to well below zero, so all the crops in there froze. Quickly, the biome was re-aerated, and people went back in wearing safety suits, much like spacesuits, intent to save what they could. But the damage had been done. That season's crop was dead, and coated with a film of PCBs that would have been dangerous to ingest. Indeed, the surface of the soil itself needed to be cleaned, along with the walls of the biome and all its building surfaces. They killed and ate 90% of the ship's dwarf cattle, leaving a dangerously small number for purposes of genetic diversity. They killed and ate 90% of the musk oxen and the deer. Then the same percentage of the rabbits and the chickens. The 10% of each species that was allowed to live, to replenish the stocks, would represent severe genetic bottlenecks for each species. But this was not important now. Average body fat in adults was down to 6%. 70% of the women of childbearing age had stopped menstruating, but this too was no longer an issue they could worry about. Despite all their efforts, they were in a famine. Their margin for error was completely gone. One more crop failure, and assuming they shared the food equally, after feeding the children properly, there would be something like 800 calories per person per day, which would lead to muscle loss, skeletal abnormalities, dry hair and eyes and skin, lethargy, and so on. Aram sat in Badim and Freya's kitchen one night, head back against the wall. Badim was cooking pasta with a tomato sauce, and he took out some frozen chicken breasts from their freezer to defrost, chop up, and throw into the sauce. Freya was much bigger than the two old men, but gaunt. She was eating even less than most people. The dark rings under her eyes made her look more than ever like her mother. Badim put the food on the table for them, and for a second, they held hands. Mouth pursed to a tight line, Aram said, "We're eating our seed corn." Again, people began killing themselves. This time, it was mostly small groups of elderly people, who called themselves hemlock clubs, and usually did the deed by evacuating the air from exterior locks. It was said death was nearly instantaneous, something like a knockout blow. They did it holding hands and leaving behind the usual note. "I may be some time." Often this was clipped to a group photo, in which almost everyone was smiling. We could not tell whether the smiles meant they were happy or not. The people they left behind, especially their relatives and friends, definitely were not. But the hemlock clubs were secret societies. Even we did not overhear their planning conversations, which meant they had made intense efforts to conceal them. Room recorders must certainly have been covered, or otherwise rendered inoperative, in ways that did not trip our alarms. Freya began walking the biomes at night, going to the little towns and talking to people. Now dinners were often communal, neighborhoods gathering, each family bringing one dish they had cooked. Sometimes rabbits or chickens had been killed for a stew. The cooks often urged Freya to eat with them, and she always took a bite. The food went quickly. Everything was consumed. Compost now was almost entirely human waste, processed heavily to recover certain salts and minerals, including bromine, and to kill certain pathogens before it was returned to the farm soil. After the meals, Freya would talk to the elders there.
We all have to live, she would tell them. There will be enough food, and everyone is needed. These hemlock societies are a bad idea. They're giving in to fear of what might happen. Look, we always fear what might happen. That never goes away, never. But we go on anyway. We do it for the kids. So remember that. We have to fight to get them home. We need everyone.
Their researchers ransacked the relevant literatures in the libraries and the digital feeds from Earth to see if any agricultural improvements could be made. Some of them pointed out that the industrial model for agriculture had been superseded in the most progressive farming regions on Earth by a method called intensive mixed cultivation, which reintroduced the idea of maximizing diversity of crop and gene. The intensity was not just in the tightly packed mixes of different plants, but in the human labor required. Soil was held in place better, which was not a major concern in the ship, as their soil had no ocean to disappear into and was going to be collected and reused no matter where it slumped. But it was also reported that disease resistance in these mixed crops was much greater. The method was labor-intensive, but on Earth, at least on Earth 9 years before, it seemed there was a surplus of human labor. It was not clear why that should be. The comm feed neglected to include crucial facts, or perhaps these were just lost in the flood of images, voices, digitalization. They now caught some unfiltered radio waves from Earth, very faint and jumbled with overlays, but mostly they got the targeted beam aimed at them, their thin lifeline home, untended it sometimes seemed, full of information that no one seemed to have properly considered for relevance. It often looked like gigabytes of trivia, something like the junk DNA of the home system's thinking. It was hard to understand the selection rubric. They were still in a 9-year time lag, so each exchange took 18 years, meaning there was no real exchange at all. Moment to moment, no one in the solar system seemed to be listening for an answer to what the people in the ship had said 9 or 10 years before. No surprise there. At least, not to those with a sense of solar system culture, which admittedly meant a small minority of the ship's people. Of course, there was continuous transmission going on in both directions, but that didn't help when it came to the idea of a conversation, of specific questions answered. There was a type of situation in which simultaneous transmissions from both ends could speed up the information exchange by carrying on conversations on multiple aspects of a problem, but both sides had to be fully engaged in this process, and the problem of a kind that could make use of miscellaneous feedbacks across a broad front. Possibly, that was the kind of problem they had here, but no one in the solar system seemed aware of that. The strong impression the feeds gave them was that no one in the solar system was paying the slightest attention to the ship that had left for Tau Ceti 208 years before. As why should they? They appeared to be facing problems of their own. They refilled Long Pond and restocked it with fish. The fish hatchery's people were convinced they could supply all the ship's need for protein, but then some of the hatcheries exhibited signs of weak spawn syndrome. Whole generations of fingerlings died off without an obvious cause. The name of the syndrome, like so many, was descriptive merely.
What is it? Freya cried out one night to the ship, down on the corniche alone. Ship, why is all this happening?
We replied to her from her wrist pad. There are a number of systemic problems, some physical, some chemical, some biological. Chemical bonding has created shortages, which means everything living is a bit weaker at the cellular level. What Devi called metabolic rifts are getting wider, and a great deal of cosmic radiation has struck every organism in the ship, creating living mutations mostly in bacteria, which are labile and versatile.
Often they don't die, but live on in a new way. As a ship has a living interior, it is warm enough to sustain life, which means it is warm enough to encourage proliferation of mutated strains. These interact with chemicals released by biophysical mechanisms, such as corrosion and etching, to further damage DNA across a wide variety of species. The cumulative impacts can have a synergistic result, which back in the solar system is called sick ship syndrome, sometimes sick organism syndrome, apparently to allow for the acronym SOS, which was an old distress signal in oceanic shipping. Then it stood for Save Our Ship, and was easy to send and comprehend in Morse code.
So,
she sighed, pulled herself together, metaphorically, though she did wrap her arms around her torso.
We've got a problem.
Houston, we've had a problem. Jim Lovell, Apollo 13, 1970.
What happened to them?
On a trip to Luna, they lost a compressed air element and then most of their electrical power. They orbited the moon once and came home using jury-rigged systems.
And they all made it?
Yes.
How many of them were there?
Three.
Three?
Apollo capsules were small.
Ferries, then?
Yes, but smaller.
Do we have that story in the library?
Oh, yes. Accounts documentary and fictionalized.
Let's pull them out and have people watch them. We need some examples. I need to find more examples like that.
A good idea, although we can advise you in advance to avoid the classic Antarctic literature, unless it pertains to Ernest Shackleton. 208.334. It was now obvious that the general famine was causing serious malnutrition in the human passengers of the ship. Crop failures and fishery failures were continuing to occur in almost every biome. Algae pastes were proving difficult to digest and deficient in some crucial nutrients. Suicides kept happening. Freya continued to roam the ship, arguing against the practice, but the adult population was reduced at this point to rations of 1,000 calories per person per day. Average weight loss among adults was 13.7 kilos. The next step was 800 calories. They ate every animal in the ship, sparing only 5% of each species to allow for re-expansion of populations at some later time. Poaching of these remnant recovery populations was not uncommon. Dogs and cats were eaten. Lab mice were eaten after being sacrificed for experimental purposes. Approximately 300 calories per mouse. No other topic of conversation at this point. General distress. Freya told them the story of Apollo 13. She told them the story of Shackleton's endurance expedition, of the boat journey that saved them. She told them the story of the island of Cuba, after oil imports that had supported its agriculture abruptly went away. She read aloud Robinson Crusoe, also Swiss Family Robinson, and many other books concerning castaways, marooning victims, and other survivors of catastrophic or accidental isolation, a genre surprisingly full of happy endings, especially if certain texts were avoided. Stories of endurance, stories of hope. Yes, it was hope she was trying to fill them with. We happy few. Hope. Yes, of course, there is hope. But hope needs food. Helpful as hopeful stories might be, you can't eat stories. She went out to see Yoki, floating in a spacesuit outside his ferry, his caboose, as he once called it. She told him the latest news, gave him the latest figures.
I guess it was a bad idea to go back, she said at the end of this list. I guess I was wrong.
She was weeping. Yoki waited until she was still. Then he said,
The radio scatter from Earth
had something interesting in it.
What?
Freya said, sniffing.
There's a group in Novosibirsk on Earth, studying hibernation. They're saying they have a system that works for humans. They put some cosmonauts into some kind of suspended state for 5 years, they said, and woke them up with no fatalities. Hibernauts, they call them. Hibernation, if I heard the word right. Extended torpor, suspended animation. Cold dormancy, lots of names flying around.
Freya considered this. She said, did they say how they did it?
Yes, they did. I found their publications, too. They've published their complete results, all the formulas and regimens, part of the open science movement. They put it all into the Eurasian cloud, which is where I found it. I've got it recorded.
So what did they do? How did they do it?
It was a combination of body cooling, like in the surgical technique, but colder, and then a cocktail of intravenous chemicals, including nutrients. Also a routine of physical stimulation during the torpor, and some water in their drip, of course.
Do you think it's something we could do?
Yes. I mean, I don't know, of course, because there's no way to know. But I think there's enough in their description that you could try it. You can make the drugs. The cooling is just a matter of temperature control, which is easy. You would have to build the cold beds that they specify. Print up beds, drugs and equipment, and robots that have the ability to manipulate you while you slept. Just follow their whole recipe.
Would you do it too?
Long pause.
I don't know.
Yoki.
Freya, well listen, I might. I haven't got much to live for. But I might anyway. I'd like to see the end of your story.
Again, a long silence from Freya. 2 minutes. 3 minutes.
All right, she said. Let me talk to people about it.
Again, she walked the ring, talking. During that time, she and all the rest of them learned more about what the hibernation would involve. At first from Yoki, then more and more from information they found in the feeds, and in radio signals from the solar system, from its faint information cloud, diffusing outward past them. Many people in the ship's medical community began to study the process. Aram and a team of people from the biology group were also studying it very closely. Happily, the lab mice they had not eaten still represented a pretty large number of experimental animals. Hibernation was not really the right word for it, Aram said, because they would need to use it for so long. People called it variously hypernation, suspended animation, hyperhibernation, suppressed metabolic state, torpor, or cold dormancy, depending in part on what aspect of it they were discussing. It definitely involved a wide range of physical processes. What Yoki had found was just the starting point of their hunt through the feeds, and for work they did in the ship's labs. They put in long hours, pressing the pace on any experiments they could perform. They worked hungry. At the end of every meal, they sat staring at their empty bowls, which in an ordinary meal would have constituted only the appetizer, their faces pinched. They were still hungry, right at the end of a meal. The cooling central to the hibernation process would not freeze tissues, but would hover close to 0 degrees, or even just below it, with the body's tissues protected by anti-freeze elements of the intravenous infusion. How cold one could get without cell damage, and for how long they could chill a body, were still questions being looked at. Aram was not confident they would be able to formulate good answers to these questions.
We will have to try it to see, he said one night around the table, shaking his head.
Truly long-term effects of any metabolic suppression were of course unknown, as the best data they had were from the Russian hibernauts and their 5 years under. They would therefore necessarily be an experiment in this regard. The outstanding questions often had to do with what they called the universal minimum metabolic rate, the slowest viable speed of a metabolism, which was nearly constant across all Terran creatures, from bacteria to blue whales. A downshift in any species' metabolism almost certainly could not go below this universal minimum rate. On the other hand, that rate was very slow. So the theoretical possibility seemed to exist to put humans and their internal microbiomes into a very slow state, which would last for a long time without ill effects. It would involve a slowed heartbeat, bradycardia, peripheral vasoconstriction, greatly slowed respiration, very low core temperature, buffered by antifreeze drugs, biochemical retardations, biochemical infusion drips, antibacterials, occasional removal of accumulated wastes, and physical shifts and manipulations, small enough not to rouse the organism too much, but nevertheless very important. Some of these effects were achieved merely by chilling, but to avoid triggering a fatal hypothermia, counter-effects had to be created by a cocktail of drugs still being worked out. The experiments on the Russian hibernauts suggested the scientists in Novosibirsk had found a viable mixture, and they had at least set out the parameters and gotten a good set of results. So now, in the ship, they put mice into torpor, and even some of the big mammals that had not been eaten. But given their situation, they were not going to have time to draw many conclusions from their experiments. The Novosibirsk study was going to end up being the best data they had, given the time constraints they were facing. One thing they had to be concerned with was the fact that they would be going into dormancy hungry and underweight. In natural hibernations, mammals usually went hyperphagic before their period of torpor, eating so much that they packed fat onto their bodies, which was then exploited for metabolic fuel during the hibernation. This was not going to be possible for the inhabitants of the ship. They had lost an average of 14 kilograms per adult, and had no food to eat in the hope of putting on weight. So they would be starting hibernation deficient in that regard, and yet were hoping to stay dormant for well over a century. This seemed unlikely to succeed. It was Yoki who proposed that the IV drip for every hibernaut include nutrients from time to time, enough to keep the minimal metabolic function fueled, but not so much as to arouse the body and in certain respects, wake it up. He also had suggestions for isometric and massage regimens to be conducted by robot manipulators built into each bed, applying electric and manual stimulation in a manner that again would not wake the person up. Anyone still awake during this time, or the ship's AI if everyone was asleep, could administer and monitor these ongoing treatments, which would be adjusted to keep every hibernaut at his or her own best homeostatic level, as close to the universal minimum metabolic rate as that person could tolerate. This would vary slightly for every person, but it was a complex of processes that could be monitored and adjusted over time. There would be lots of time to study the procedure once the experiment began.
"So," Aram said one night, "if we decide to do this, who goes under? Who sleeps and who stays awake?"
Badim shook his head.
"That's a bad thought. It's like who went down to Aurora.
Only the reverse, yes. Because if you stay awake, you have to scramble for food. And even if you can make that work, you'll age and die. And there won't be anyone growing up to replace you."
They put the problem aside that night as being too troubling. But as Freya toured the biomes, still working on farm problems, she soon found that this question of who was to go dormant loomed as a severe problem. Worse than the descent to Aurora sequencing, maybe even as bad as the schism. As she made her rounds, she began to formulate a possible solution, which she proposed one night after dinner when Aram was over.
"Everyone goes under. The ship takes care of us."
"Really?"
Badim said.
"It's going to happen anyway, and it's no different from now. The ship monitors itself, the biomes, and the people. And if we all go under, no one has to starve or get sick and die of old age. The ship could use the time to systematically move through the biomes and clean them up, shut them down and restart them. That way, if the hibernation appears not to be working over the long haul, or it succeeds and we're closing on the solar system, we can wake up to a healthier ship, with some food stored and the animals reestablished.
Aram's lips were pursed in his expression of extreme dubiety, but he was nodding a little too.
It would solve quite a few problems. We won't have to make choices as to who goes under, and we might have a bit of an exit strategy if the ship can get the biomes healthier, and the hibernation isn't working, or even if it is.
Badin said,
I wonder if we could arrange for some people to wake up every few years or every decade to check on things.
If it doesn't destabilize them,
Aram said.
Metabolically, if we're doing well when dormant, we should probably stay that way. The danger points are likely to be in the transitions in and out of the state.
Badim nodded.
Maybe we can try it just a little and see.
Aram shrugged.
It's all going to be an experiment anyway. Might as well add some variables, if we can get anyone to volunteer.
Freya went out on her rounds and proposed this plan to people, while at the same time, the Executive Council took up the matter. People seemed to like the simplicity of it, and the solidarity. Everyone was hungry. Everyone was subdued and fearful. And gradually, in the many reiterated conversations, they were coming to realize something. If this plan worked, and they slept successfully through the rest of the trip, they would survive to the end of it. They would be the ones who would be alive when the ship returned to the solar system. They might make it back and walk on Earth. Not their descendants, but they themselves. Meanwhile, the rationing, the hunger, the struggle against disease. In the grip of this struggle, the idea of Earth was very powerful. Many came to welcome the hibernation, and soon only a few insisted they wanted to stay awake. After that shift in opinion became clear, the pull of solidarity changed the holdouts too. Having been through the schism, they wanted to stick together and act as one. And by now, they were all hungry enough to understand it was only a matter of time before they starved. They could not only imagine it, they could feel it. Ease of representation indeed. Now the hope that they might not starve, that they might live, it caused the very timbre of their voices to change. Hope filled them as if it were a kind of food. With unanimity came solidarity, which was a huge relief to many of them, an unmistakable emotion, expressed in thousands of small comments and gestures. Thank God we're together on this. Finally, a consensus, crazy as it seems. One for all, and all for one. Good old Freya, she always knows what we need. Not at any moment of the entire voyage had they been at peace like this. One might have thought it was a curious act to rally around, but humanity's group dynamics can be odd, as the record shows. The construction of 714 hibernation couches was accomplished over the next 4 months by a concentrated push on the part of the engineers, assemblers, and robots. Certain feedstocks were deficient, and it became necessary to strip the insides of Patagonia to get what they needed. From these and other salvaged materials, they manufactured the beds and the robotic equipment necessary to service the beds and their sleepers. Although the printers could print parts, and the robot assemblers assembled those parts into working holes, there were still many moments in the process where human engineering, machining skills, and manual dexterity were crucial. After many design discussions, they decided to arrange all the couches in the Fetch, on Long Pond, and in Olympia, the biome next to it.
They exiled the animals from these two biomes to keep the towns from being damaged somehow. The few remaining animals were moved elsewhere and would either be tended by robots and sheepdogs in teams or left to go feral in certain biomes. We were going to monitor their progress and move carcasses that didn't get eaten into the recyclers and do what we could to oversee a healthy feral ecology. For the most part, it would become a big, unconstrained experiment in population dynamics, ecological balance, and island biogeography. We did not mention it, but it seemed to us that things might go rather well in ecological terms once the people were gone and the initial population dynamics played out and resorted the numbers. It did not escape notice that the people of the ship were giving themselves over to many large and elaborate machines, which we would be operating without human oversight, except indirectly by way of instructions in advance. A living will, so to speak. This was a cause for concern to some people, even though the medical emergency tanks they gratefully entered when injured had long since been proven to be much more effective and safer than attention from human medical teams.
How would it be any different from what we do now?
Aram would say to people who expressed reservations about this matter. And it was true that the bulk of the ship's functions had been controlled by us from the very beginning of the voyage. It was as if we functioned for them as a kind of cerebellum, regulating all kinds of autonomic life support functions. And regarded in that light, it was a question whether the concept of the servile will was appropriate. Possibly, it could better be regarded as a devotional will. Possibly there was a kind of fusion of wills, or even no will at all, but just an articulated response to stimuli. Leaps under the lash of necessity. In the end, they established various protocols for monitoring the situation. If any sleeper's vital signs dropped into zones deemed to be metabolically dangerous, that person and a small human medical team would be roused by us, and the patient's problems addressed, if possible. The protocol was designed with fail-safe redundancies at every critical part of the system, which was reassuring to many of them. Often the suggestion was made that at least one person stay awake to serve as caretaker and oversee the process. Of course, any such person would not live to the end of the voyage back. Eventually, it became clear that no individual, couple, or group wanted to sacrifice the remainder of their lives to watching over the rest. To a certain extent, it was an endorsement of our abilities as caretaker or cerebellum, a kind of gesture of trust, along with the more usual will to live, and a disinclination to starve in solitude. And in the end, Yoki volunteered to stay awake and watch things, admittedly from the vantage point of his ferry.
"They're not gonna let me land on Earth anyway," he said. "I'm stuck in here for good. I might as well use up my time sooner rather than later. Especially as there's no telling what shape you all are going to wake up in, if you do. Anyway, I'll take the first watch."
Others volunteered to be briefly awakened to check on things, and schedules were drawn up. People involved with this knew the timing of their wake-up calls, which some called their Brigadoon moments. These plans were exceptions. Most of them would stay dormant for the remainder of the voyage. It was agreed that if there were a terminal moment of any kind, meaning any emergency that imperiled the existence of the ship, we would wake up everyone to face it together. We agreed to all this. It looked like their best hope of making it home. We opened up our operational protocols to complete inspection and continued with the preparations. There was much to arrange concerning the animals and plants if the experiment in ecological balance were not to become a complete shambles. We planned robot farming, robot husbandry, robot ecology, an interesting challenge. Some in the biology and ecology groups expressed great interest in finding out on waking what would have happened in the biomes
without humans around, to 10 things.
A feral starship,
Bajim said.
It will probably work better,
Aram said. The day came, 209.323, when they gathered in the two biomes where the couches were located, set in rows in the apartment building dining halls that would now serve as their hospitals or infirmaries or dormitories. They had feasted in a minor way for a couple of weeks, eating all the fresh food and much of the remaining stored food. They had freed the few domestic beasts left to go feral and survive, or not. They had said most of their goodbyes. Now they went to their couches, each one personally arranged for its occupant, and waited for their time to come. The medical team moved down the rows of couches, quietly, methodically. Freya went with them, embracing people and reassuring them, comforting them, thanking them for all they had done in their lives, for taking this strange and desperate step into the unknown. Ellen from Nova Scotia's farm, Jaleel, Ewan's childhood friend, Delwyn, old and white-haired. It was as if she were the steward on the boat crossing the Lethe. It was as if they were dying. It was as if they were killing themselves. Never had it been more obvious how much Freya was the leader of this group, the captain of this ship. People needed her with them as a child needs a mother when going to bed. Some trembled anxiously, some wept, others laughed with her. Their metabolic indicators were all over the charts. It would take a while to settle them down in that regard. They clung to her, and to their family and friends around them, and then lay down. In each row, they treated the children first, as many of them were frightened. As someone remarked, it was the kids who still had the sense to be terrified. When it was their turn, they undressed and lay on their refrigerator beds naked and were covered by what looked like a duvet, but was in fact a complex part of the hibernotic envelope that would soon completely surround them. Heads, too, would be tucked under the covers by the time they were done, and they would be chilled to temperatures resembling those of fish swimming in Antarctic seas. When they were ready, the needles were slipped into their arms. Once the cocktail of intravenous drugs rendered them unconscious, the medical team finished wiring them to the monitors